This is Bloomberg Business Week from Bloomberg Radio.
Hi, I'm Jason Kelly.
And I'm Carol Masser. Welcome to the weekend edition of Bloomberg Business Week. Over the next couple of hours, we'll bring you news of the week, insights from the magazine, and more. And safe to say, Jason, that the big story, I mean, there was a lot going on this week, no doubt about it, between the impeachment and, of course, State of the Union. But the virus was definitely front and center, the whole world looking at it.
Well, and not to mention the Iowa caucuses, which we thought, oh, okay, that'll give us some clarity. It gave us exactly the opposite. And coming up, yes?
Well, I was going to say, if there was a theme this week, it was uncertainty
totally.
On so many different levels, and that really played out in the magazine and certainly with a lot of conversations we had.
So we're going to bring you all of that in the first hour, and next hour we're going to bring you highlights from our trip last week to the Bloomberg Power Players Summit down in Miami. We're going to hear from the owner of the Buffalo Bills, as well as John Skipper. He used to run ESPN. Now he runs DAZN.
And now to this week's cover story.
Let's understand what's underneath it. This is the big story of the week, obviously. Here's editor Joel Weber. Man versus microbe. An arresting cover, to say the least, on a really important story. How'd you get there?
Yeah, this was the story of the moment, really, right? And we've seen it just continue to capture attention worldwide as this virus has spread. Our measures have been largely adequate so far in terms of containing it. You know, and China's been very aggressive in sort of quarantining, as have the U.S. But there's a bigger problem here that I think this story really addresses, which is we don't have a long-term focus around incentivizing anyone to deal with these things in a really proactive way. It's always firefight, firefight, firefight. And the drugs aren't working,
right,
and the viruses are becoming more prolific and spreading faster.
Well, I think that's a really, and you guys asked the question, are we ready for it? And it's obvious that we're not, because all of a sudden we are chasing a vaccine, and you do talk about incentives. And I think that's a really interesting component to this, that the public sector policymakers need to be involved.
Not just the public sector, but the private sector, right?
Yeah.
There's no incentive for a drug maker to put down everything it's working on and immediately scramble something to market, especially when, you know, the patents become somewhat of an issue, which we saw pop up here with China this week. So I think the real question here is, like, how as a society do we deal with this? Like, microbes aren't going away. They've been with us for a really long time. We've actually gotten very good at fighting them, but that's a recent phenomenon. You know, polio, that's only a 100-year history with our success in that matter. And as these things proliferate, we're not ready for it.
All right, Joel Weber, thank you so much. A really powerful look from a number of different angles at this.
And while companies are warning that they may be hit, it still might be too early to tell. And that brings us to this week's remarks.
Here's economics editor Peter Coy. He wrote those remarks, taking a look at the economics so far and where we may go. How'd you get into this?
I mean, it's the obvious question. Where is this going? I'm focusing less on the death toll, as serious as that is. That was more the other story in the package, more on the economic consequences. So the surprising thing is, if you talk to people at Bloomberg Economics, people like Tom Orlick, they're saying the outcome is likely to be fairly modest. So they're saying that they predict that for the full year, 2020, China's GDP should grow about 5.7%. Which is only 0.2 percentage point less than they had predicted before the outbreak of the virus. And that's in their baseline scenario. If things are a little worse, let's say they can't contain it, their worst, not quite worst case scenario, but their somewhat worst scenario is that containment in the second quarter, that'd be 5.6% GDP growth for the year as a whole. So what they're predicting is that this will be contained, and then there'll be a V-shaped recovery. Down steeply and then right back up again.
But I feel like the conversation initially was like, you know, this might just be a little bit of a blip, but I feel like it's turned a little bit, Peter, to what we don't know kind of thing. I mean,
there's
still a lot of questions out there.
There
right?
are certainly a lot of questions, and Tom Orlick and team are the first to admit that.
Yeah.
Things could turn out differently. You know, if you're an economist, you kind of got to go with what you have at the time, and that's what they've come up with. But as my story gets into, there are a lot of ways in which this could turn really sour. And the obvious one is that the virus is less containable than predicted so far. We've seen spreading to dozens of countries already, deaths outside of China. China, of course, itself is by far the worst hit, especially Hubei province and Wuhan. But we're seeing cases Europe, Asia, and of course, North America and the United States.
Well, and one of the things, to the point of the unknown unknowns, is even in countries like Cambodia and the Philippines, they've essentially been saying, you know, it's not a big deal, and yet there just may be cases we don't know about
yet. That's really scary because, you know, certainly the United States, Western Europe have highly sophisticated technology for monitoring and testing. Some of these countries don't. And so China is special in that it has the worst outbreak, but also the ability to pose draconian restrictions on its own population to allow to shut this thing down. You go to another country with a weak public health infrastructure and a lack of that ability, and you can easily imagine the disease raging out of control.
I also think once we hopefully get beyond this, right, and new cases, and hopefully it's minimal, you know, ultimately, and that the economic impact is reduced as well. But I do wonder about, as you say, kind of the longer-term consequences on the relationship between U.S. and China. We've had some U.S. officials make some comments that certainly feel like they're off-color.
Well, see, of course, the Chimerica, the tight union between the China and the United States, which benefited both countries, is becoming apart already over U.S. concern about job loss, the heightening military contest between the two countries, Trump's trade war and so on. This becomes yet another thing that would tend to drive these two world's two largest, most powerful economies apart. And you can imagine that lasting even after this virus dies down.
And that's economics editor Peter Coy. A very smart take because, aside from the obvious human tragedy here, the economic implications are still very much unknown.
Right, and that's exactly what he gets into. Despite people putting out numbers and projections, you have to remember that there is still so many things that could make it a very different outcome. The comments heard around the financial world, it happened late last year, saying it, one billionaire, someone who is among the most successful money managers in America. Jason, we're talking about Ken Fisher.
And he took a big hit as a result, big institutional investors pulling their money. Mm-hmm. And yet, here he is grinding on the retail machine. And Sabrina Wilmer and Janet Lauren, they describe everything that's happened and describe the state of play and where it may go from here. Sabrina's here with us in New York. Phenomenal story. You have been following this from the beginning, really from those first comments. Remind us how we got here.
In October, Ken Fisher spoke at a San Francisco conference, and he made some sexual remarks, which caused a person to go onto Twitter and express how upset he was about the remarks, and then other people came forward, and it just caused a lot of anger among people. And then I actually interviewed him shortly after that, and he said those types of words, but they were taken out of context, and that he said similar things in the past many times, and nobody questioned it. And then following that, Some big institutions started pooling money, like Goldman Sachs and Fidelity, and about $4 billion left the firm in a month.
But, I got to tell you what blew my mind, too. Yes, $4 billion sounds like a lot, but from what I understand, he still manages about $121 billion.
That's
he still manages a lot of money.
And assets have actually grown since the crisis. And part of that has to do with the stock market. And he puts a lot of his retirees mostly in stocks, so that helps. And, I mean, this story kind of takes a step back and looks at how he built his business. He's quadrupled assets since 2009. And a lot of that has to do with his marketing and sales operation.
Step back, though. A lot of who invests with him, though, are individual investors.
Like,
let's remind everybody that even though a Goldman and a Fidelity pulled out some money, the bulk of his investments at $121 billion is individual investors, right?
Yeah, it's mostly individuals across the country. And I interviewed some of them for the story and asked them what they thought about Ken's remarks. And one woman that I quoted said she doesn't really mind what he said, and she thought that political correctness has gone too far. And what she cares about is how her portfolio is doing, and she's pleased with the performance in the portfolio.
So you went out to see Ken
and some attorneys out in California. And take us there, because even the way you describe this scene is really, really well done. Because it speaks to essentially what he's very successfully built over decades.
Yeah. I mean, he's very different from anybody else in finance. And his whole thing is to basically try to get away from Wall Street. And he tells customers, you know, you can't trust brokers. And this location that I went to is as far away from Wall Street as you can get. I took an Uber all the way up this, you know, steep mountain with, you know, redwoods, and you could see Half Moon Bay from there. It was beautiful, but it's not the place that you would imagine, you know, a multi-billion dollar asset manager running their operations.
It's like a sort of a compound on the top of a hill in the woods.
Yeah, and when I got there, I thought maybe I was in the wrong spot,
right?
Because I just saw this sign saying Country Store,
right?
And then it's kind of, the office is set back where you can't really see it from the street, and there's really nothing around. You just hear birds tweeting. So when I went in there, I mean, it's beautiful views. You see this bull and bear statue, right, out on the patio. But that's,
then you knew you were in the right place.
Yes. But that's where he started. You know, that's where his first headquarters was.
Right.
And he actually lived in that office with his family.
So what I think is cool is you got some time with him, and I'm curious about what he had to say about everything that happened. And, you know, I think there's been some concerns about culture at his company as well. So what did he have to say about all of this? Because he really, mm-hmm, I think you're right in saying he harkens back to a different era in Wall Street. I'm not forgiving it. Mm-hmm. I'm just saying a different time.
Right. I mean, he apologized a number of times for what he said. He still said that his words were taken out of context. He also said that the media was in part to blame for some of these outflows. He said that some of the institutions probably wouldn't have pulled money if it wasn't for pressure from the press. Mm-hmm. In terms of his culture, he said that he disputes the boys club type description, and I did interview a number of employees who described this sort of boys club, and you know, how Ken's words were part of this macho environment, mm-hmm, particularly with some of the salespeople, the account executives, and he hires these people right out of college, and from my interviews, these people had a lot of like a frat boy type, you know, attitude. And you can kind of see that in my story through some email exchanges,
right,
in one incident.
Well, and it's interesting too, because you do really go deep into this culture that is, as Carol says, sort of harkens back to this very, you know, almost cinematic, like sell, mm-hmm, sell, sell. I mean, I think you, right, have a line in the story, which is great because it really evoked it for me. It's like a David Mamet play, yeah, you know, just,
right,
like always,
exactly,
be selling, you know, 200 plus calls a day. And it has been, to be fair, an incredibly successful model. You know, this sort of blanket marketing approach has won a lot of customers.
That's right. I mean, it's a big part of his whole business. I mean, Ken Fisher came back and basically said, well, there's more to my business than just sales. It's about the customer service. Mm-hmm. And you do hear about that from some of his customers. Just, they love the luncheons that he puts on. And so he's talking about how it's – and then he talks about his performance.
Right. I just want to follow up on,
yeah,
that, because, you know, part of what he's selling is a fairly high fee product,
yes,
in a world that's getting closer, mm-hmm, and closer to free for money management.
Right.
So it's anachronistic in some ways.
That's right. Because, you know, he is even though he disputes this, he is an active manager. They pick stocks.
Mm-hmm.
But he says that, oh, this is what we do different. We provide service to and advice unlike other companies. So that's kind of his argument. But it is kind of, I think it is, based on my reporting, most of this has been driven by marketing, because he's written all these books,
right,
too. And, you know, you kind of recognize him from the ads that he puts out and bashing annuities and
right.
And to be fair, I think we, Bloomberg, at different times have certainly run his ads on our media properties.
And had him on our shows.
As a guest as well. Mm-hmm. So let's get to it. I mean, that's a lot of money to have under management, and it hasn't gone away, even though there's some controversy over those comments. There's been some charges about how money is managed. What has been his performance? What kind of performance returns have we seen from him?
Well, it hasn't been spectacular. If you look at the 10-year performance, they have a specific benchmark that they set. It's not the S&P. It's MSCI Global Index. And on a 10-year basis, it actually misses the benchmark. 3- and 5-year basis, it beats it by 1 percentage point.
So shorter term, it's been beating, but longer term, it has not.
Yes, for the 10-year.
Yeah. Right.
So it's kind of mixed.
So what was your takeaway from all this? I mean, you've followed it literally from the beginning. You've covered the money management industry for a long time. As you finish this story up, what'd you make of it?
It was an unusual process. I've never kind of encountered this situation before. I mean, this is kind of a shift in financial services where people are starting to speak out about, language, sexual language. And I think this marks like a turning point for the financial services industry where people are held accountable. So that's part of what I learned. It was just a very interesting process.
Yeah. And yet, he's still very successful, still managing a lot of money. I mean, right?
That's right. I mean, I think most of the outflows have already happened.
Yeah.
So it's really yet to be seen how the company internally is going to change.
Right.
He has vowed not to say these types of things ever again. They've started a diversity and inclusion task force. And that's just starting to get off the ground. So it's yet to be seen what's going to happen with that.
You know, one of the things that struck me, you know, knowing and following your work very closely over the years, Sabrina, is that, you know, you have a keen understanding, too, of the difference between institutional and individual behavior. And that does seem to be at the core of this, right? You know, that institutions are feeling more and more pressure, public pressure, to act in a certain way. And yet you have individuals, in this case, it feels like, who are essentially saying, listen, if the guy's making me money, you know, it feels almost like a political statement to some extent, right?
That's right. And if you go on social media after this, you can see the divide on this. I mean, some people reacted saying, oh, what Ken said is wrong. And other people were like, this is political correctness gone too far. So right. it is a political divide.
Right.
That's Sabrina Wilmer. And Jason, what I love about this, she's been covering this story since last fall when Ken Fisher made those comments that really were heard throughout the financial world and looks at the repercussions. What I love is she's met with the man. She's talked with Ken Fisher. She went to his company and really digs into who he is, his background, and also takes a look at the company culture.
Well, and that company culture and really just the relatively novel way that they have marketed, that's what's gotten them to $100+ billion. And there are some questions as to how it all works.
And so much of that, of course, is individual investors. We're talking about the retail community.
That's right.
Not the institutional community.
This week, caucus chaos, a technical glitch in Iowa, upended the opening act of the 2020 Democratic presidential primary.
Plus, China's coronavirus outbreak has triggered an unprecedented travel ban to and from the world's second largest economy. We break down the potential impact on global markets.
Really one of our big stories this week. And Business Week talks. We speak with Verizon CEO Hans Vestberg on the company's partnerships with Apple Music and Disney Plus and Amazon.
First up, the caucus. Here's Josh Green. He was there and now he's back in D.C. That's where he joins us. He writes on the mess that Iowa made. The ramifications of this are going to be widespread. They already are in many ways, Josh. What is going on?
Well, nobody really knows. I mean, the Iowa caucuses, which traditionally, shape the field, winnow the lesser candidates, and deliver two or three winners who typically go on to become the nominee. Instead, this year, the entire process broke down on caucus day. There was a faulty app, a bug in the code. It's days later. you know, we're just now getting what look like full election results. And on top of all that, the takeaway is a virtual tie between a moderate and a radical, somebody who draws older voters and younger voters. So essentially, the Iowa caucus settled nothing at all. And now the whole party moves on to New Hampshire.
Well, they move on to New Hampshire, but they also missed an opportunity, right, Josh? Because Iowa is often seen as a launching pad, whether it's for fundraising, whether it's for media coverage. I mean, this is an important, or usually an important first step.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, look, the party really, really screwed up here. I mean, typically the winner of the Iowa caucus gets a bump in national polls of about 12%. You get glowing media coverage. Very often you get millions and millions of dollars as a candidate. And a lot of candidates, especially those who don't have a big fundraising apparatus, count on that in order to be able to move forward and have a viable path to the nomination. So if you are someone like Pete Buttigieg, who doesn't have a ton of money but looks as if he performed well in this campaign, if he'd gotten a clean win, he could have been that guy rocketing to the top of the polls. Bernie Sanders, if he had gotten a clean win, you know, he could have really pushed aside other people in the field and set an emerging narrative that the Democratic race is taking a big shift to the left. Instead, it's still not clear exactly who won. Functionally, it was a tie. But because there weren't clear results, it also didn't force out some of the weaker candidates who underperformed. Like Amy Klobuchar or Joe Biden.
Well, and Josh, I want to take you back to the screw-up itself, because you documented an effort by the Democratic Party last year to really engage in a much more sophisticated, technical, high-tech way. That was underneath all of this. Tell us about that.
Well, you know, basically, both parties are looking to modernize, and Democrats have invested a lot of money in trying to improve their technology. The breakdown in the caucus process stemmed from an app, and I got an exclusive interview with the CEO of Shadow Inc., which is the company that built the faulty app, and got him to explain to us essentially what happened on this nightmare caucus day, how it broke down, and where that left Democrats. But where it left Democrats is looking very badly. I mean, the process failed, and the fact that they can't run a caucus when they're trying to make an argument that they should be giving the reins to the country and oust Donald Trump isn't a good look for Democrats, and as I said, does nothing to clarify who the eventual nominee could be. We might even be headed for a contested convention, which would be unprecedented in modern American politics.
And that's Josh Green. Always a treat to catch up with him. He is exactly who we wanted on the ground in Iowa, especially when things went awry. And you were the first to really connect the dots. And he certainly connected the dots while he was out there, because this was meant to be this amazing evolution, almost revolution, in the Democratic Party,
right,
using technology in a way that the Trump campaign did back in 2016 to really take this process to the next level. And it went exactly the other direction.
Think about the conversations we've had this week talking about Silicon Valley, how they are considered certainly big supporters, of course, of the Democratic Party. So you would think the Democratic Party would have the latest and greatest when it comes to technology. And yet to see this debacle play out in the Iowa caucuses just kind of blows your mind.
And I feel like it was one of these things that over the course of the week, we kept waiting. It's like, okay, are the results out yet? Are they out yet? I mean, I was reading something that said some people just had to put it in the mail, you know, so it goes from basically relatively low tech to potentially high tech to the lowest of low tech. And candidly, it robbed, as you heard Josh say, a lot of the potential front runners from a fundraising boost and
right,
any sort of momentum going into New Hampshire.
I love in his story, and I think this is just a really kind of smart bottom line on what he wrote. Josh wrote, he says, a full year of campaigning has done nothing to settle the central debate within the party between those who believe a nominee must steer leftward to excite and attract new voters and those who believe that such a course would guarantee President Trump another term. Iowa's neck and neck finish between Buttigieg, the moderate, and Sanders, the radical, is the party's conundrum that, you know, has come to life. And, right, the party still has not kind of come behind who they need to be going forward.
to beat the president.
Well, and you couldn't have predicted worse timings in many ways for the Democrats. It comes on a week where the president is acquitted. Mm-hmm. The president gives his State of the Union address, which for a president in a re-election year is really a campaign speech.
And check out the polls. He's more popular than ever, right? So it really has come together certainly for the president and the Republicans this week, and not so for the Democrats. We'll see what happens going forward.
Right. New Hampshire next, then mm-hmm. on to Nevada, and then South Carolina. So we'll see, as you say, where this goes and how far-reaching the implications of this debacle in Iowa are.
So time to check out Pursuits. The editor of Pursuits is with us, Chris Rauser. And the opener to Pursuits this week has to do with bonuses. And we cover bonuses a lot right here at Bloomberg.
They're always the most read stories on the terminal this time of year.
But Pursuits has their own unique twist on it.
They do. I like it. So where did you go with this?
So, you know, some of the coverage that we've been doing about bonuses is that they're flat this year, or that bonuses reflect less individual performance and more company-wide performance. So you might not be getting this crazy surprise. So since, you know, the end of what we used to think of the bonus as might be coming, we thought, okay, you should take your bonus and you should buy it, or you should spend it on something that will appreciate. So, you know, your bonus is an appreciation of yourself. You should get something that will appreciate in the world.
So like spend it well, right?
Spend it well. Something that will be worth more in the future, either worth more with money or worth more in your life or in culture or in helping people.
Right, exactly.
And it's not a boring list. It's really a mixture that you guys have come up with. It's really a fun list.
Yeah, so we wanted to have a lot of different things. You know, you don't have to buy the specific piece of property that we recommend upstate, but, you know, thinking about buying a piece of property.
Looks nice.
Yeah, it does look nice. We have a farm upstate, like a working farm that you could actually maybe like make money off of for $3 million up in the Hudson Valley.
200 rolling acres. That's big.
That's a lot. That's maybe too much land for me to deal with. But,
but then, you have people for that.
Exactly. But you know, you can buy a pair of limited edition Nike Air Max sneakers for $120. And those actually go up in value. A Chanel boy bag can go up in value 70%. You know, you can buy a piece mm-hmm. of art. You can buy a nice knife for your kitchen so you never have to buy a knife again.
Right.
All these different things are things that become more valuable over time.
Well, and talk about some of the investments, as it were, and the appreciation, I should say, that comes from like a museum membership, you know, mm-hmm. like those sorts of things. That was intriguing to me.
Yeah. So there's different tiered memberships at the Metropolitan Museum of Art here in New York. And sometimes they give you access to early openings, so you don't have to wait in line for all those crazy shows. Or, you know, you have special access to curators who walk around and teach you about the art that you're seeing and the background of it. And then you can use that information to impress people at a cocktail party.
Right.
You can use it to invest in art yourself. But that's like useful information that people don't always think about.
Well, you do. And you kind of take that to another level, because take that art appreciation and you can actually buy a piece of art like a Hockney, right?
Yeah, exactly. Like Hockney has got a super hot market right now. There's a lot of stuff coming up to auction, really stuff that's beautiful to look at and vibrant and interesting. And you know, he's a person that the market's just going up and up.
Right. You also touch on essentially what's almost the next level of ecotourism in mm-hmm. some ways, where you're seeing some beautiful things, but then contributing some work, and then in some ways sort of paying it forward by paying for somebody else to go on something of an excursion. Right?
Yeah. So a company that we love is called Elevate Destinations. Yeah. And when you go on a trip, you can actually help them do research about elephants, and they invest in sort of improving the relationship between humans and elephants. Most trips where you interact with elephants are actually not good for the elephants. So like this is something people need to learn about. And then also that company gives money to kids to visit local cultural sites in the region, which is just paying it forward in a way where you're not even there.
I have to say, one of the things that really jumped out for me, I love animals, is the one about helping out pets in Puerto Rico specifically.
Yeah.
I love that idea because there's a lot of animals that were hit by the storms there, the hurricanes.
Mm-hmm. For $400, you can adopt a pet. And as we say, your heart will grow more than you ever thought possible.
All right.
Oh, wait. You left out one really good one. The liposculpting for guys.
Oh, yes.
Who knew it was a thing?
Yeah. Oh,
I've already
yeah.
invested.
You can do it on your body. You can do it on your face, actually, around your mouth. This is Dr. Ryan Ninesteen in New York, who is one of our favorites, plastic surgeon. Always has like the new hot thing, and this is one of his.
Neither.
Renuvian, yeah, that's what it's called.
just adopt the dog.
Adopt a dog.
But maybe we've already had it done and you just didn't notice how good
that's
we look.
That's the best kind.
That's
work.
What that 2-week vacation was about.
Exactly.
A little
exactly.
healing there.
I wasn't actually adopting a dog in Puerto Rico.
Well, maybe not adopting a dog, but maybe adopting a title.
We love
this story. Tell us about this one.
This is amazing. So Benedict Kamel in Germany is one of our favorite writers. You guys know him.
He
pitched this story about how in Germany and also in some other countries in Europe, you can actually buy a a title. So buy your way into the aristocracy. And the way that you do it in Germany is you get somebody like a princess or a countess to adopt you as an adult. You become their child. And
okay, can I just say on radio, they can't see Jason's face. They're just like, really?
It's just amazing.
So go ahead.
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
So, and it's a thing, you know, it can cost 80,000 euro to become a count. It can cost up to 800,000 euro or way more to become a prince or a princess.
Different titles obviously cost
different. So like, and there's, you know, there's a lot of aristocracy in Germany, which is why this is a little bit more common there. And people who do it report that it actually makes a difference in the way they go through life.
So the von whatever Habsburg family that all of a sudden finds out that a crazy aunt like adopted somebody and gave them a title, they have no say in any of this?
Yeah. So people try to protest it because they don't like to dilute sort of the value of their name, but there's not really, if you're legally adopting somebody, there's nothing that you can actually do about it. So they, you know, there's Zsa Zsa Gabor's husband, Prince Frederick, bought his title because he got a princess to adopt him. And then he's passed it on to a bunch of people, a brothel owner, you know, all these, someone who owns a bunch of gyms.
Yeah. Like, I know. I love the detail about like the guy who owns Killer Sports and parades around, I'm reading from Benny's story here, parades around in tasseled military uniform.
Yeah.
It's incredible.
Because, you know, most people don't know. And if you're in Germany, if you have a von on your name, people treat you differently when you go to restaurants, and it helps you get a bank loan, we hear. So like it really actually does change these people's lives.
We hear that James Tarmey, who writes for Pursuits, also has a title. But that's a story for another time.
Investigate that.
All right. So if you're not wearing military tassels, maybe you're wearing a brooch. Emphasis on bro.
The bro. We're trying to make it a thing. So you may.
How much fun did you guys have in the newsroom with this one?
This was great. And, you know, we did a lot. You know, we did this story because we've seen this a lot. So men, especially on the red carpet in Hollywood, are wearing jewelry on their lapel. So lapel pin. Jason Momoa had this great Cartier Art Deco piece when he was at the Golden Globes recently. And, you know, stylists.
When he was actually wearing his jacket and wasn't sleeveless.
Yeah,
sitting
was wearing
his
a tank top.
That amazing.
He can kind of wear anything. Yeah.
And so, but we've seen it out and here in New York too. I was at a party at Saks last night and I saw a bunch of men wearing pretty like blingy jewelry on their lapels. And it's just another way for, you know, jewelry companies to sell. And they've really been struggling or trying to find ways to open this market up to men. Tiffany just launched a men's jewelry collection.
Yeah.
And it was trying to be sort of really masculine. It was like jeweled dog tags and things. But some companies are just saying, no, we just want like some fancy jewelry and
we just want a brooch.
Well, I mean, because the fact of the matter is, and we've talked about this vis-a-vis watches before. I mean, it is difficult. Sorry, smallest violin for men to accessorize in a lot of ways. It's like the best you can do is like wear some funky socks. Mm-hmm. You know, there's just not a lot you can do.
Woe is me.
I know it's terrible. It's
but
terrible.
You could also get a really cool watch because that as well. To us about these perpetual calendar watches.
I love perpetual calendar watches.
I love all watches.
I
we
do
know
love
that.
All watches. I absolutely cannot afford a perpetual calendar watches, but these are watches that they give you the day, the month, sometimes the week of the year, and they don't screw up on leap year.
So ever. Like
they ever. Well, in 2100, we're as humanity, we're going to screw up the Gregorian calendar a little bit to get it right back.
Well, climate
on
change
solar
will
time.
Have us all gone.
Yeah,
anyway,
we'll be
so
gone. Don't
it
worry.
Matter.
But until then, these watches are totally accurate. Most of them are self-winding, so you wear it around, it winds itself, and it's just perfectly timed for such a long time. And because it's so complicated to do that, they're very expensive. The cheapest one that we have is an IWC, which is $28,000. And then we have ones that go up to $800,000.
All right.
My phone, I mean, $1,000.
Your phone is never wrong.
Right, that's true.
Can't wear it on my wrist. Well, kind of,
as
I guess.
As long as it's working. I have to ask you about what I would dub the anti-Costanza.
Yes. I'm very big into this.
Thin wallet. I have to say, I've thought a lot about this because my wallet got a little too Costanza-ish, you know, way too fat, and I just sort of pared it back. It is hard to find like the right one, though, the right sort of thin wallet.
My husband's pared down to like something very tiny for just his cards and just really small.
Often you have to, when you wear a small wallet, like a billfold style wallet, often you have to have a money clip too because you can't fit a lot of bills in there, so you put your money in your front pocket. But if you wear this slim kind of billfold style wallet, it doesn't screw up your back. Like people don't realize they're getting sciatica or whatever that is because they're sitting on their wallet. And so we have this beautiful, very, very soft, like unbelievably soft one from Loewe. It's $265. It's based on their puzzle bag, which women carry. And I just fell in love
with it. Stunning.
this one. Yeah.
Are other people doing it? Like, I feel like the brands like Coach and so on and so forth have done
Coach
this for a while.
Coach has great ones. I have a Mont Blanc one that I really love.
And Shinola does a really nice one too, because in their sort of leather collection.
Right.
Yeah, and they're, you know, they can be kind of boring. The thing I like about the Loewe one is it's got colors. Yeah. It's kind of interesting. So I got my husband one that has a hedgehog painted on it. Like people those comment on it when you pull it out. It's kind of fun.
That's Chris Rouser, the editor of the Pursuit section. I had so much fun with this. First of all, of course, the opener talking about how to be smarter basically with your bonus dollars because they're not as big as they were before. But come on, let's get right to it. Don't you want to buy a title? Don't you want to be Prince Kelly?
Don't you think that people would pay even more attention to our show if it was Lady Von Masser and Baron Von Kelly?
Oh my God, totally.
It would take us to a whole new level. I think we need to look into that.
You've been working on that, haven't you?
It just came to my mind.
It's just clever. It's a fun
story. Do you
think
I can expense that? It would be really good for business.
Jason, about this $80,000 to become a prince?
And also you got adopted?
Or baron? Yeah, exactly.
Can you imagine explaining that one to Debbie Kelly?
That is so nuts. Anyway, it's a fun read. You must check it out. It's something to talk about over the weekend with your friends. And then for you guys out there, buy a brooch.
Yeah, brooch. Emphasis on the bro.
First, we want to start with, of course, the coronavirus, still the biggest global story. It is the cover of Business Week magazine this week. Nobel laureate Paul Krugman stopped by our daily show this week to talk about the virus specifically, his thoughts on what's going on in China and beyond those borders.
So, Paul, from an economic perspective, from a market perspective, the market still seems to be trying to figure out. But you mentioned this new world that we're living in, this value-based supply chain, I think is what you said. Help us understand the economic implications here.
Okay. So, I wrote a column because Wilbur Ross said something truly boneheaded, which is not that unusual, but it was a good jumping off point where he said, this is great for America.
Right.
Help us compete with the Chinese. And that wouldn't have been totally boneheaded 40 years ago, when you actually did have a world where kind of national manufacturing bases competed head-to-head with each other. But now we're in this world of these complicated interlinked value chains where, I've got an iPhone in my pocket here. Where was that iPhone made? Well, the last step was China.
Right.
But in fact, that's the last step of a very long and winding chain. And there are pieces of it that were made in many places, and it's been shipped across multiple borders. And in that kind of world, anything that disrupts manufacturing anywhere is actually going to hurt manufacturing everywhere. And so the coronavirus, and that's actually, by the way, most of the evidence says that all of the people who've actually done evidence said that the Trump trade war has actually hurt U.S. manufacturing, not helped it. And the reason is because of the value chains. What it did was it disrupted, it raised the cost of U.S. manufacturers by raising the cost of imported inputs. And the coronavirus is kind of like the Trump trade war on steroids. If it turns out to be as serious as we fear it might be, it's going to be a really pretty nasty thing, even for people who are not at all at risk of being infected themselves.
I feel like, going back to your book, that we're at risk, too, of kind of creating a better future if we have folks putting out these ideas that have been, you know, disproven, if you will, and that they don't make sense. And we certainly see that among politicians. I do wonder, do you have faith in maybe the private sector to kind of move things along? Elon Musk, for instance, like him or not, he has certainly pushed forward the idea of an EV that many traditional automakers, Paul, would have said it's going to take much longer to do. And I feel like he's moved up that. So do you have any faith in kind of the private sector moving along some of these ideas?
Well, sometimes. I mean, I do say in Arguing with Zombies that the overwhelming problem, the one I have sometimes, I ask why isn't it the only thing I write about is climate change. And the private sector has actually set us up to solve that problem. Hmm. We've had this incredible technological revolution in renewable energy, and electric vehicles is part of that because it means that we can electrify a lot of transport as well, and we can generate the electricity in ways that don't generate greenhouse gases. And that technology is already – now, government policy helped. Without some of the investments that took place, particularly under the much maligned Obama stimulus, the green energy wouldn't be where it is right now. But the private sector also did its part and delivered this great technological stuff. The trouble is, first, that's sometimes not enough, and sometimes the politicians are fighting it. So we have the Trump administration trying to force us to burn coal, even though the private sector really doesn't want the coal anymore.
Right. What's the best economic lens to look at the Iowa caucus and the early Democratic vying for the nomination?
Boy, I mean, I have, by the way, zero idea what's going to happen. Yeah. And the but the caucus is it's a deeply unrepresentative state and a deeply peculiar. Somebody once said a caucus is an artisanal primary, right? It's a it's a really bad way to judge what voters actually want, and with a highly unrepresentative set of voters. So this is really bad. Now, God knows. I mean, it's. But let me tell you, it might be decisive for the nomination, particularly if Biden wins. That may be kind of it. But if he doesn't, then probably slog on for quite a while. But my insight is that in terms of actual policy, it hardly matters which Democrat wins. As long as a Democrat wins the general election, that Bernie Sanders has a lot of big plans, but in reality, he would only be able to do part of them. And Biden, you know, may be kind of old guard, but he's actually offering a pretty progressive economic program, and his party would force him to go through with that.
Right.
So the reality is that we're going to get a Democrat who, in practice, would be what Europeans would call a social Democrat.
Right.
Would expand the safety net, raise taxes on the rich, and I'm not going to get worked up at all about who ends up in the lead.
Well, and one of the zombie ideas that you talk about in your book is the myth of the socially liberal, fiscally conservative voter. So there's a lot of things that are very relevant to today.
Well, yeah, there are. I know some socially liberal, fiscally conservative.
Yeah, you know a lot.
I actually tend to encounter. Well, I basically encountered them in the breakfast meetings at Bloomberg. and they have an average net worth of maybe a thousand times mine, at least. And they all wear gray suits, and they are absolutely not. There is nobody out there. They effectively represent maybe 3% of the electorate.
We just want to spend a couple more minutes with Paul Krugman because we've got him here. Obviously, teaching now at the Graduate Center of the City University of New York. And when you came in, Paul, you and Carol were talking about an interview she did with you down in Princeton. You're now a full-on resident of Manhattan. What do you make of New York City right now?
Oh, you know, if you can afford a place to live, which is the hard part,
right?
It's a golden age of New York City. I mean, crime is low, the cultural richness, whatever your tastes are, is enormous. The food is better by far than it was when I was growing up. You know, and life is surprisingly easy. You know, and anything you want is 5 minutes away. So, I'm a huge fan of New York. I'm a fan of the subway for all of its problems. It's a very efficient means of transport.
Right.
So
you're a bull.
I'm a bull, and you know I grew up on Long Island.
Sure.
And I always thought I would someday grow up to be a New York intellectual, and finally in my 60s I made it.
You made it.
But you made it.
Yeah.
Which is great. Well, and I do wonder about, bringing more people and making it more equal within the city. Do you think that's something that we can fix, whether it's developers' responsibility or whomever?
No, we definitely need housing. Affordable housing is probably the biggest single thing that you can do. I mean, there are other things. Universal pre-K is great, but we should have even more child
right.
support, and that's something that the city can do. But building more housing for regular people, it's a dense city, but there's in fact still plenty of room for that. And that's the biggest, it's always going to be a highly unequal city because it's a place where billionaires want to live.
Right. All right.
So
exactly.
There's always going to be some of those.
10 seconds, got a favorite part of the neighborhood
in the city? Because I live on the Upper West Side, and
yeah.
it's a wonderful place.
And that's Nobel laureate Paul Krugman. Excited to catch up with him, especially because this new book, Arguing with Zombies, Economics, Politics, and the Fight for a Better Future, couldn't be more timely. So we were down in Miami last week. We were there just a few days ahead of the Super Bowl. We broadcast from Radio Row, they call it, and with all sorts of folks. But we also helped host an event. It was called the Bloomberg Power Players Summit.
That's right, Jason. And we had a chance to have a conversation with Kim Pegula. She's the owner and president of the Buffalo Bills, also the Buffalo Sabres. So they have, she and her husband, a lot of exposure to the sports industry. And it was fun to talk to her about a lot of things. We did talk a little bit about being a woman in what is predominantly a field, an industry dominated by men, but also about becoming really connected with your community where the team is based.
Right. The future of football, fan engagement, and her priorities for the next decade.
One of the questions I want to ask you, and forgive me, but what's it like being a very successful woman
in a sport that is so dominated by men.
It's awesome. I'm sorry. I'm not.
Is it really all awesome?
I'm not trying to make anyone jealous, but I have the best job in the world. There's a lot of challenges, of course, but I can tell you, just I'm having so much fun. I love.
Was there
what
ever
I do.
Any moment though where they're like, "Oh, Kim, what does your husband think about this?"
No. You know what? My husband and I, we've been married for about 27 years, and he has been a great partner of mine. And I remember when we talked about the bid coming up to buy the Bills, he's like, "Kim, you got to get on board because I can't do this, and you know, without you, and certainly that." So he's always been my biggest supporter, and I've been very grateful. But then at the same time, he's like, "All right, you go do it." So he's like, "It's great to have the support, but then you realize you're the one doing all the work." Not always, but that's what it feels
sometimes.
But it's great. Being an owner, I'm so blessed. I love it every day.
So what's the big challenge for you right now in 2020? Obviously, a lot of focus this weekend because it is the Super Bowl. It's a good time to sort of take stock of where you are as an owner. What's number one on your list?
You know, really, we would not be here without our players and our fans. And so every year, regardless of our wins, our losses, every year is a new challenge because, the 49ers were, you know, they were almost one of the worst teams last year, and this year they're in the big game. And so every year is different, and you can't always, count on what you did right or what you did wrong. But the fan base, trying to re-engage with them, all the new technology that comes through. You got new players. The struggles that any business have when you don't know what it is. So I think that's really it is. Just how do we keep engaging our fans? How do we keep building on what we have?
How do you do that? Because we've had some conversations in planning for this. Jason and I talk about it with our own families, that there is so much, and I think George Pine used this expression, like competing for some mind space. You know, you want the fans at the games, but you also want to keep them engaged when they're away. So how do you compete with so much that's out there?
Well, and we found that, you know, we used to think that you could kind of compete with another club. You're competing against another league, you know, basketball, hockey, whatever it is. But we found that we're really competing for people's time and the convenience because they're able to do, you know, go on their phone and get a ride to wherever they want to go. They can have groceries delivered, right to your door. And so people are now expecting out of their experience all the ease and convenience that they're getting from all these other industries that, you know, before we didn't think were our competitors. But certainly now they are because they want that same level of expectations from our fans do.
Kim, how do you create a club and create sort of an ethos around the club that's reflective of the city? I mean, Buffalo is an American city in so many ways, for good and bad, especially now in 2020. So what is it about the team that reflects the city?
Well, you know what? I really do. There's, sometimes I feel like we can't, as a club and the league, sometimes they have a lot of rules, right? And of course, you know, we got to play within those rules. But I think that authenticity that, you know, we talk about a lot, I think that you have to really embrace that. So in Buffalo, we have this thing called Bills Mafia. It was not started by the club. In fact, we kind of really shied away from it because we're like, oh, that's kind of like a negative undertones. We're not, you know, not that kind of family. But that's what the fans like felt like they just embraced it as their own. And now we're like, no, let's partner with that. Let's embrace with that because that's who we are. So really understanding our core fan, who we are, and then allowing them organically, naturally, to help us really be who we are as a team. And any of our players, you'll see there'll be like a shout out to Bills Mafia. Like, they get it too. They feel it.
All right, for our Bloomberg Business Week listeners tuning in around the country, we're here in Miami talking to Kim Pegula. She is the president and CEO of Pegula Sports and Entertainment, owner and president of the Buffalo Bills and the Buffalo Sabres, we should point out.
So one thing I want to ask you is, you are thinking about, and it's some of the conversations we've been having here up on stage, is that you want to think about your existing, maybe older fan base, right, who want to interact with the game and the team a certain way, and then you got your younger consumer who you also want to engage because you want to have them around for decades to come. How do you balance that as a team owner? You know, you've got to think about resources and so on and so forth.
I think that is so hard. I mean, that is one of, you asked me earlier about one of the struggles, and I think that truly is. It's the best thing about sports. Like, our fan base is anyone from, like, you know, a new baby that's got their, like, my first game shirt. And then I've got, you know, people that, like, 100 years celebrating their 100th birthday at a football game. And so how do you cover that whole, I mean, it's the best thing, like, to have that fan base that spans so many generations, but it presents a lot of challenges.
Well, speaking of challenges, we just had four, you know, incredibly successful athletes who have moved on in some ways, you know, co-founding businesses, co-founding a league, some still playing. We talked a lot about the role of social media, players using social media, managing their own brands. How do you, as a team owner, kind of get your hands around that? What's your view on that?
Well, no, I'm very a big proponent of our players having a voice in a brand, because I do think, like I said, they are representing your team, and the players aren't coming to see me, they're coming to see our players. And I think there's such power that they have with the influence, and if we can help them. So we have a program, the league has done a much better job in the recent years of allowing for that. And so we have a program where we actually, well, because, you know, the players on game day, like, they're supposed to be focusing on the game. But they've got fans, they've got family, they want to have fun. And so we, like, provide extra videographers, extra camera crew, extra people that will take pictures, and we'll send it to them and say, hey, we're not using this. Why don't you can share it with your fans, or you can share it with your family. You can do whatever you want with them. Because it's social media is time consuming. Oh my goodness, I have a Twitter account and I got an Instagram, and it's like, it's a lot. And now we're on TikTok, right? So, like, you got to do the Facebook for your older generation now. Then you got to do TikTok, which are completely, and everything in between. It's a lot.
That's Buffalo Bills owner and president Kim Pegula talking to us from the Bloomberg Power Players Summit. Interesting to hear, as you said, Jason, you know, it's a new type of owner. This is someone, she said, took over the franchise after the previous owner was there for a long time.
For the whole history of the team.
Exactly. So it took several years to kind of make your own imprint, and that's kind of where they are right now.
So we were down in Miami last week. I just like saying that. Ahead of the Super Bowl, we were there for the Bloomberg Power Players Summit.
Exactly. And Jason, I had a panel focusing on tackling sustainability through sports. And when you talk about sustainability, you're talking about a lot of things. Yes, going green, being green, but you're also talking about diversity and inclusion. So we covered a lot of things.
And I have to say, this was such an interesting sort of pairing of people in some ways. Joining you was Al Guido, the president of the San Francisco 49ers, Dallas Mavericks CEO Cynthia Marshall, and Kirk Tanner. He's the CEO of Pepsi North America.
Al, let's start with you. All right, San Francisco, you have this amazing stadium. I mean, you even have a dashboard, I believe, when you go there where fans can check out how green you are. Tell us about this stadium, why you guys did it.
Look, I think for us, being in the Bay Area, it sort of was a staple that we wanted to be green. We wanted to be sustainable. It came down. It was an edict from our ownership group, Jed York. We wanted to be the first stadium that was ever built LEED Gold. There have been a number of stadiums that have opened and then became LEED Gold, but it was important for us to do so. And a lot of things went into it. Some of it is the location in the stadium and where we picked it. Obviously, all of us in the sports business have this challenge of having 70,000 people come down to a stadium. So how do you actually do that? How do you reduce the carbon footprint, the number of cars? Well, build a stadium next to two forms of public transit, get 15 to 18% of your people using those public forms of transit on game day. It was great for us. The second, we really wanted to be, you know, it was ambitious, but we wanted our game days to be powered by the sun. So we partnered with NRG and SunPower. We have over 1,800 photovoltaic panels in our building. We use that stored energy, and we literally power Sunday via the sun.
That's amazing.
There's a number of other things in the recycled water on top of our stadium. We actually have a 27,000 square foot green roof where we actually use those products inside of our concession stands from our cooking perspective. But at the very highest levels, I would say it starts with ownership, it starts with leadership. It was important for our organization to really put a flag in the ground and make this an important thing for us. And I think a lot of the other stadiums that came on board after us followed.
Cynthia, I want you to come into it, because speaking of sustainability, you were brought into a situation at the Dallas Mavericks that wasn't sustainable.
Correct.
So talk to us. First of all, I think everybody's probably heard the story. Mark Cuban, I think, calls you, right? Yes. And you're like, who is this?
I didn't know him.
You didn't know who he was. All right.
He didn't know me either, so it's okay.
But you're a smart lady, and you get up to speed,
yes.
And you find out, and you go to meet with him, but you don't think you're going to take the job to work with the Dallas Mavericks. Tell us a little bit about what was going through your head and what you knew of the problem.
Right. Well, first of all, I had just retired from AT&T.
You were in retirement.
You're right. So I just retired, started a consulting company, and it was a consulting company focused on leadership development, diversity and inclusion, cultural transformation. And so then I get this call, and I went to talk to him. And on my way over to his office, I read the Sports Illustrated story. And that's when I thought, I don't know if I want to do this. I don't know if I'm going to want to be a part of this. But obviously, the person who I talked to was so focused on a cultural transformation. And Mark says, I need you to come in. We have some issues here. I need you to come in and help us. And as I was leaving his office, two women stopped me to tell me their stories. I came back the next day and said, I gotta do this. I just have to do this because what I have learned is it takes leadership. And you talked about that. And the tone has to be set at the top. So here's an opportunity to come in, be a part of something truly that would be sustainable, to create a culture and a climate of diversity and inclusion, not just diversity because there's a difference, but true inclusion, a sense of belonging, really having people wanting to be a part of it, really appreciating people. And so I got a chance to do it. I said yes, and it's been 23 months, and the NBA just gave us the Inclusion Leadership Award for the progress. The work is not done.
Right.
But we've made a lot of progress.
That's it. Congratulations. And I have to say, I've been quoting you because you say there's diversity and inclusion. Diversity being asked to the party.
Being invited to the party. Inclusion is being asked to dance. So you can invite me to the party and have me as the only black at the table, the only woman at the table, and your numbers look good and I look good and we think we've done something great, but then I don't feel included because you haven't taught me the rules. You haven't taught me the dance steps. Everybody's doing something, all the fellas are doing it, but I don't know what you're doing. And so inclusion is about teaching me those moves and making sure that I can be successful at that table.
And I want to get come on in, Kirk.
Would you like to dance?
Oh, Cupid Shuffle. You got to do Cupid Shuffle. Let's go. Let's go.
I would love that. Kirk,
I got
come
no
on.
Moves. No moves.
That's Al Guido, the president of the San Francisco 49ers, Dallas Mavericks CEO Cynthia Marshall, and Kirk Tanner, the CEO of Pepsi North America. I love this conversation. It was about sustainability, diversity, inclusion. But what was really unique, Jason, is they all came at it from a little bit of a different perspective. And so together, you got a really rich conversation. So we were in Miami last week. It was really nice and warm. Loved being there. It was just ahead of the big game, the Super Bowl, for the Bloomberg Power Player Summit. It was this incredible networking and gathering of athletes, of team owners, so many different folks involved in the sports world.
And one of those people, Carol, I was really excited about this conversation ahead of time. And man, did he deliver. John Skipper. We talked about streaming. Of course, he knows the media world, the sports media world, as well as anyone. He was the president of ESPN, now with a fast-growing startup called DAZN.
Well, in my career, I mean, it was an extraordinary inflection point when you went from a paucity of sports on broadcast, right? The broadcast networks did less than 1,000 hours a year of television. In my last year as president of ESPN, we did 90,000 hours. So that was an inflection point of availability of content to fans.
And that was cable, really, that created that, right? Yeah.
And it was, of course, also a transition from an over-the-air broadcast signal to a more stable connection, whether it be satellite or coaxial cable. But this inflection point, which is moving from pay television to over-the-top streaming, is going to be just as profound. I mean, look, it's already happened in music. And look how profound that is. Instead of going to your Tower Records and bringing home a sack full of vinyl, you pay a very small amount of money and have all the music, or 83%, I just made the number up, of all the music in the world available to you on your smartphone. That's a spectacular consumer experience. Change the business model. You now have, we're right in the middle of the movement of general entertainment to over-the-top streaming. And all you read about every day is the introduction of Disney Plus. Here comes a new Peacock. What is the next series of content on Apple TV? What's HBO Max going to look like? What is Amazon going to do? What is Facebook going to do? It's a remarkable change. Over time, it's a better value to the consumer. It unbundles the bundle, which doesn't mean you won't have a reaggregation of over-the-top content. You will. And it also provides advantages in more volume.
Yeah.
You're going to go now from 1,000 hours to 90,000 hours to 2 million hours, and pretty much everything is going to be available. You're going to be able to pick and choose more, and then you have the advantage of interactivity, two-way communication, which will allow people to have personalized experiences, betting, fantasy, gamification, chat rooms, and conversations happening during the broadcast. So it's a profound change and a better consumer experience. The question is, what happens to the business models?
Right. Okay. So let's talk. I mean, let's get into it, because everything you said sounds awesome, sounds amazing, especially from a consumer perspective. And yet, you know the joke that people will sit down to try and watch a movie on a Friday night, and they'll spend an hour just on Netflix, and by the time they decide what they're going to watch, it's time to go to bed. You know, uh-huh. I mean, that sort of uh-huh. paralysis.
I'm more efficient than that.
Well, you're a more efficient guy in general, but, you know, and that's just with a couple of platforms. Some of the things you've talked about haven't even fully rolled out yet. How is a consumer to make sense of what they're going to put their dollars to?
I don't actually know that this is literally what happens, but I think it's instructive to think about a family sitting around the dinner table and deciding what they're going to buy. And the winners are going to be those people who are the first choice or the second choice or the third choice, because not many people are going to subscribe to more than five or six
yeah.
services, which, by the way, may still include a light aggregated pay TV bundle.
Right.
But they're going to add Netflix. I mean, Netflix is fairly ubiquitous now within a certain socioeconomic group of people in the United States. Even if you go to a place, if you go to Brazil, you know, the plurality of homes at a certain socioeconomic level and above all have Netflix. They have it in Canada. They're going to have it in India and everywhere else. So the fight now is between HBO Max and Peacock
yeah.
and Disney and Apple and Amazon Prime. For where are they in the lineup of which services people are going to choose? We are sports only, so we have to work our way into that consideration set. We have a very simple way to do that. That does not mean that it is trivial to execute, but we know from our experience in Germany, Japan, Italy, that if you have first-tier sports content, you are going to make the cut.
Right.
In Italy, we have Serie A, which means if you're a Juventus fan, 3 out of every 10 Juventus games are on DAZN. It's the only way to watch them. We have a very large number of subscribers in Italy. Same thing in Japan, where we have the J-League football, soccer, and we have Japanese baseball. So we have a large business in Japan. We have some Bundesliga games in Germany. We've got a high business. It's easy to do.
Yeah.
It is not inexpensive. The technology is complex. The reason music happened is audio is easier to stream than video. The reason entertainment happens before sports is because archived entertainment that sits at the head end of in the cloud is easier to
pull
down.
Just pull it down. Yeah.
The hardest thing to do is we're going to have a live game, and we're going to produce that and deliver it to you at the same time as everybody else. Last year we did more than 100 games events in which we had an audience of over 1 million people watching the same thing at one time. I do not think anybody else in the world has had that experience. And that is the complexity of that is why this will happen over a certain period of time. It's funny, I was just talking to somebody who said, when's the Super Bowl going to be on over the top? The Super Bowl might be very quickly over the top as a choice.
Right.
Exclusively over the top.
Yeah.
You couldn't do it right now. You just couldn't. It wouldn't be stable. It wouldn't be a good experience. But if 5 million people wanted to do it because they weren't in front of the, you know, they weren't at home or they didn't have a pay TV subscription, that could certainly be a compliment, which I would urge the NFL to think about in their next round of deals.
Well, let's talk about that very point, because for a long time, media rights, when it comes to sports, have been, and keep me honest here, exclusive, right? I mean, and you don't have so much of these sort of complementary situations. Is that changing? Is it changing fast?
Well, it's interesting. It depends on where you're talking about. At ESPN, our point of view was it is not acceptable to bifurcate the linear stream and the over-the-top.
Right.
Of course, the NFL did that on Thursday night.
Yes.
When they sold a linear stream to Fox and they sold an over-the-top stream to Amazon.
Amazon, right.
So I think you will see some positioning and struggle and I think some leagues will try to bifurcate the two.
Yeah.
Now, I'll tell you something ironic, that while I just said that, our point of view at DAZN is that we want exclusive content. We may, in certain cases, be willing to be non-exclusive. I'd take the Super Bowl non-exclusively. But when we bought the Serie A rights in Italy or the Japanese baseball rights, we bought them exclusively. They are not for... It's okay if you want to get your pay TV subscription. We want to move people over. We want a transformation. We don't want to be a complimentary service.
Right. And for those of you listening on Bloomberg Radio, Bloomberg Business Week, I'm speaking with John Skipper of DAZN, formerly of ESPN. So as you think about sort of sport by sport, you guys have a really nice footprint in boxing, obviously here in the United States. You talked about some of your soccer slash football rights overseas. What's the next big growth area for you that takes DAZN to the next level?
Look, it is, you want to, what you need to do to build a subscription service, and we're in 9 countries, 4 continents. We're in Brazil, we're in Spain, we're in Italy, we're in the United States, we're in Canada, we're in Austria, Switzerland, Germany. You got to start with something that matters, right? Here we started with Saul Alvarez, Canelo. He matters, so you can move people over. You got to start, in Canada we have Sunday Ticket. You got to start with something that matters. You got to build around it so that people, well, you can retain their subscription, you can make sure they're there all the year, and that they watch more. If we can get people to watch 5 events in a month, it's almost certain that they'll stay with us the next month.
And that's John Skipper, executive chairman of DAZN, former president of ESPN. You sort of can't make this guy up in many ways. I love his accent. I just love his whole approach. You know, he rocks up onto the stage, you know, not wearing socks in his shoes. He was full on Miami.
All right, that wraps up the weekend edition of Bloomberg Business Week from Bloomberg Radio. Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Carol Masser.
And I'm Jason Kelly. Be sure to tune in to Bloomberg Business Week Radio, live Monday through Friday, starting at 2 p.m. Wall Street time.
And if you can't catch us live, check out our daily podcast wherever you download your podcasts.
And you can also watch the show live on YouTube. Just search for Bloomberg Global News.
And of course, you can get this week's edition of the magazine. It is on newsstands now.
And we'll be back right here next week at the same time.
This is Bloomberg.